As we had mentioned Sunday morning, that this week would be on authority and on issues facing the church. I tried to define that and make it a little more defined. There are a menu of all kinds of doctrinal issues that the church has faced and is facing now and will face, and several of the men are going to be dealing with that and have already. So I decided to leave those aside, and on this week's issue, I thought I would deal with the social issues that are facing this church, and I will wrap them all up into one bundle here and try to give you not a simplistic, but a simple approach to the things that we and our children and our grandchildren are facing right now. Before we do that, I think it's imperative to take 5-10 minutes to review, and we're going to review two passages because we want to make sure we get this in our thinking. I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 8, and we're going to read again verses 5 through 13. And as I'm reading these, I want you to think about the main point. Now, there are many things to be said about this that we have said Sunday, but in relation to the subject of authority, and that's really what we're looking at here, and the definition and the reality of a spiritual, defined, absolute authority, what this reading tells us about that. Verse 5 of Matthew chapter 8, Jesus is coming down off the mountain, coming into Capernaum. And a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And he said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and the west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion Jesus said, "Go, let it be done for you, for you as you have believed." And the servant was healed at that very moment. Now, as we've said, there are many things going on here, obviously. But in relation to authority, the subject of authority, the definition, the understanding, to comprehend and to grasp what authority is, what does this passage here teach us? Think about it. What lesson are we learning from this, Russ?
Well, I think what it is that Jesus having all authority, as we talked about on Sunday, he marvels at this man's attitude. And this man is a centurion in the Roman army. He thoroughly understands what authority is all about. And he explained that and said that. And so Jesus is very surprised by this Roman and what he says.
All right. That's true. Anyone else? Roy?
Well, he tied faith and authority together in this individual.
He's marveling at this man's faith. He's not an Israelite. He's a pagan, and he's a pagan with position and power, privilege, prominence. Someone else, I thought I saw him. Well, here is this man who has not been raised with the writings of the Torah on his mind. He doesn't know that much about the customs of the Jewish people. He knows a little bit about them because he has to deal with them, but he's not one of them. Now, here's a man who is a Roman. What kind of authority? Now, we've established Sunday, and then again, as Russ has just said, here's a man who understands. He said, You don't have to come to my house. I know authority from top to bottom and in between. And he explained, as he said, I tell this man to go, and if he doesn't go, he's gone. I tell him to do this, and he better do it. He understands authority that we would term as absolute. Is there relative authority in a court martial trial with the Roman government? Could they stand before Caesar and say, well, I know that's what the commander said, but I think... Now, even... We don't have to be in the military to know how absurd that would be. The world of their authority is absolute. But what else, and how else would you describe the world of authority that this Roman centurion is living in? What kind of authority? He knows it top to bottom. But what is the nature of his authority that he knows and has lived with? It is a political authority. It is not religious. Now, here may be one of the reasons why our Lord is so amazed and marveling, that here is a man who is not religious, who is not from that background and that way of thinking. That's not his world. If anything, his world is idolatrous. But he's got to be careful about that, because he's got to owe allegiance to Caesar. So religion is not a part of his life. Yet Jesus comes not as a political figure with political authority. He doesn't come as a man with any kind of military power or authority, though he has a lot of people following him. His authority is solely religious. It's divine. Now, how is it that a political creature, a political member, now understands fully the religious, the divine authority? What is he saying about Jesus? And not only about what he says, but about what he's doing. What is he... what is he implying? That's a bad word. Let me strike that, back that out. Let me say, okay, we'll let the military man tell us. What is he saying, Al?
He's implying that Jesus has the authority.
You are on a pay grade that is above my boss. Now, if he started cohorting with this radical, religious Jew who's got the Pharisees and the chief priests all in an uproar, and if he starts cohorting with him, if he starts having an association with him, when that goes up the ladder to Rome, how's that going to look for him? He doesn't care. Now, the thing that I would take away from Matthew 8, and why I said Sunday, Matthew 8, 9 to me is ground zero for any discussion of authority. It starts right here. This is the man, more than any other character in all of the New Testament, who understood exactly what Jesus' authority meant. And he wanted the Lord to act on it, even to the point that the Lord is amazed. Now, let's hold that thought. Now let's go to another passage, Luke chapter 20, that we discussed Sunday. This is when the chief priests and the scribes with the elders, they confront Jesus, and the chief priests get to hear him for the first time. We're just going to read the first two verses. We're not going to read any further, because these discussions always get involved in what does it mean about the baptism of John. That's another subject, that's another lesson. We're going to look just at the first two verses of Luke 20. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes with the elders came up and said to him, "Tell us by what authority you do these things, or who is it that gave you this authority?" Now, earlier we had read, Sunday, that they had scolded the members of the temple and officers of the court, who had said, well, they sent him out to arrest him. And they said, well, we're not going to arrest him. No one's ever talked like this guy. You've never heard him out like this. And the chief priest had scolded and mocked them and said, are you ignorant too? What's the matter with you silly people? How foolish. Get this guy. So they go meet him. And the first thing that we are struck with is that they do not deny his authority. There's no question to say, who do you think you are? No, the question is, What kind of authority? And where did you get this authority? That is an admission that he has it. Now, what does that say to us about the concept, the subject, the definition, the understanding and comprehension of the nature of authority and his enemies? The centurion wasn't the Lord's enemy. He may have been on another side of the fence politically and physically and genealogically, but he's not the enemy. Here are the people who are the Lord's brothers. They are the clear enemies of Christ. What does this say about them and their understanding of the authority of Christ? I'm teeing it up. There you go. Thomas.
Well, it seems like they acknowledge that he has authority. They recognize it, but they're not willing to put themselves under it. They have established such a scenario in their world that it's like they're caught in this. Because if you go on, not to get into the baptism thing, but if you go on, the reason why they answer how they do in verse 7 is because they know that if they answer and say that they recognize his authority as being supreme, like the centurion did, their whole system comes tumbling down, and their authority, their power, their money, their wealth, their whole system is, they're basically collapsing it on themselves if they do that.
And I'm just looking at, Thomas talked with me about this Sunday after class. I said, that's an excellent point. I said, I'll have everyone have you stand up and tell her. He said, no. I said, I just tried to tee it up for him here. And say one other thing that you were talking to me about, Thomas, about the level of God and that how you would typify that authority. They were just under God. They, you know, we're a greater authority than any man. We're not quite there, but we're almost like we're God. And isn't that one of the earmarks of many of the religions that have come to us since then, where the leader is divine in one degree or another, and so all obeisance, all reference, preference, worship, everything goes to this man. Though he's in the flesh, he is God in the flesh. And the Pharisees, the chief priests, the rulers of the temples, had that kind of attitude about authority. And they were working against the Lord. Here is a man who's not in Matthew 8, who is working with the Lord. Two different ideas and attitudes. Neither one of them reject the authority of God, but they have two different approaches. Now, any question or comment about those two? This is our introduction, getting into the class. I know we talked a little bit about this last summer in one of our classes here, and there's no way to really keep this into one class to discuss everything. But I'm going to call this gender confusion. Every gender issue that has and is coming to us and to our children that creates so much confusion. We wonder how, you know, what do we talk to our kids about this and about that? And the kids come here with this and that, and there's always this exception and that exception. We're not going to talk about any kind of abnormality, any kind of anomaly, any kind of exception. Exceptions don't set the rule. Exceptions just they always confuse people. Now, what we're studying is the authority. I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 19, and we're just going to read three verses. Verses 4, 5, and 6. Most of us here are well acquainted with the context when they are approaching Jesus with a question that is a point of law, of divorce. And verse 4 of Matthew 19, who's he? Of course, it's Jesus. Jesus said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? You see a third alternative? Now, I'm not trying to be cute. I'm not trying to be work fast and loose. But I think, like trying to defrag our lives, we get so spread out with so many arguments and defending on so many fronts that really the first, most basic question in regards to authority is, who has it? Well, if you go to Matthew 8, the centurion will tell you, it's not Pilate, it's not Caesar, it's not me. You just say the word, Lord, and my servant will be healed. That removes any doubt. That's why there's your answer. And when Jesus says to these men and to us today, haven't you read that in the beginning he who made them made them male and female? Now that is I don't know how you could find a clearer, more profound statement from God Himself about gender. Everything else that we hear or we are told or that we read about gender today, it doesn't come from Jesus. I mean, I know I'm preaching here now, and I'm going to back away and let you fill in some blanks here, but to me it's so obvious. Read with me verse 5. He said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife. There's a male, man, and wife. And the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Then when he said, whatever God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, I will admit that when I was a younger man preaching and performing marriage ceremonies, etc., I always read verse 6 is, there's a warning from God. I've put this together. I've locked it. Don't you unlock it. I think that was, I really sold it short, and I wasn't getting the full picture, and I'm sure many of you know where I'm going with this. It's more than that. It is God who has now made them this one flesh in His eyes, that as He intended from the beginning, and it was not good that man should be alone, and He made the woman, and He didn't make another man. Now, again, not to be simplistic, but to be simple and to the point, there's the formula right there in front of us. How can we reproduce? How can we sustain our existence? That's the only model. And I think that, if we were in a class of apologetics and learning and dealing with how to defend, I think this is a point that cannot be overstated. That with whatever knowledge or wisdom or insight that whatever professors or clinical psychologists or therapists, etc., all come up with how a lesbian couple or a same-sex marriage of men can produce a healthy offspring. Well, we know it's impossible. Biologically, it would be absurd to argue. But the arguments are made that, well, while they can always adopt, well, where did that baby come from? I mean, this to me just knocks that whole argument down flat. If we have the attitude of the centurion in Matthew 8. But if we're like the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests in Luke 20, we get, well, you know, that's not an absolute. We don't have to, you know, there are other ways to raise a family. You see where we're going with this. Now, I can't help but keeping my focus on this, that this is one of the reasons. Now, this is my opinion, so take it or leave it. But it seems to me this is why people want to get away from the Bible so quickly. any kind of moral framework of truth, particularly that is absolute truth, and particularly and especially that deals with their personal life, they don't want that. Who is he to tell me this? And, of course, in the context of Matthew 19, his words weren't well received then either, for different reasons. But the divine model from Genesis to now hasn't changed. This is one of the things that, if I can just stop for a minute, get out of the authority thinking for a minute. This just amazes me. I don't know if you, many of you probably thought about this. It doesn't matter how long the earth will exist. Boys will always want girls, and girls will always want boys. I know there are exceptions, and I know there are situations when they are told, no, you don't want that, you want this over here. And their minds can be conditioned to change, but that is a natural force that is absolutely unstoppable. Why is that? Why is that? It's the way God made them. It's just the way they made them. Little boys are men in training. Little girls are mothers in training. And all the interesting little funny descriptions and anecdotes about that. We've all heard them and know them and seen them. It's just further proof. When Jesus said, have you not heard? And when Jesus said, have you not heard? I wonder if you think, really, guys? Have you gotten off that far? Come back here. Now, comment or question about the authority of Christ in dealing with gender. Gender, the confusion, the chaos, the identities, and now where we have what I would call the pronoun police, where we are living in an era now that if a boy decides he's a girl, you better call him a girl, and if you don't, that's considered hate speech. What would your grandfather think about that? The pronoun police, you got to be careful. But they, you know, this is what I am today. So you have to go through silly stories about that. Yes, Ben.
To prove your point, you put my son on the spot. He's attending college now. He was in a sociology class, where the teacher said, please, let's separate those who identify as men, those who identify as women, and those who identify as others. And it was empty. And the teacher had to say, oh, I'll just sit in the middle and fulfill that. Laughing, and it's not really a funny matter because it is, if you bring it up, it is a really confusing, serious matter because it's interesting because they move away from authority and they start moving into Jesus' love. And so there's like two terms there, misunderstanding. What authority is and what obedient love, which is what we read in the New Testament, is. And they'll use that as, if I'm a good person and I'm confused and feel this way, Jesus loves all of us. He must love me for who I am. And that's the way the thought process goes. So it's like we almost have to tie the thoughts of, you may be going there, but you have to tie the thoughts of authority and how love is defined and what Jesus demands of us and what that love really means. And it's not the way we define it these days. It is such a simple topic. Simple conclusion, but it's very hard to have those talks with people because it is, they see it as a very complex, very multi-layered type of, you know, subject.
That's right. That's exactly right. I might ask this question. In a broader sense, what does authority, now, whether you define it good or bad, what does authority bring to the table in the circumstance of people's lives? What does authority bring? What does it create? What does it give to us, whether good or bad? Al?
Assurance. Assurance of where we're going and what we are.
Does a passage bring anybody's mind about Romans chapter 13 about the obeying the authorities that are over us? And the reason why Paul says we must do that. Verse 1 of chapter 13 in Romans. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Now, where's the exception in this? I don't read one. every person be subject to the governing authorities. There was not a qualification of the good authorities, or the legal authority, the bad authorities, the ethical authorities, the other. It's to the governing, that is, those who are in charge, whether the elected or whether they by sword, as in the first century was most often the case. They were the governing authorities. How many Christians would agree with the moral principles of the rulers of Rome? None would. But they were the governing authorities who Paul is writing to in Rome. And the reason why, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God, and people immediately get off, and even God would condone the despots that have ruled and killed and murdered people throughout the centuries. No, the point that Paul is making here is that these rulers are not a terror, verse 3, to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Now, I like Westerns. I like the good ones, not the silly ones. But the thought crosses my mind regularly when I look at a real authentic Western about dealing with the real dynamic of what it was like to leave Baltimore in a covered wagon and cross the plains with all of the threats and all of the problems, etc., and then get to a Western town somewhere that doesn't have a law. How on earth did those people live in these mining camps all along the foothills along here? Well, as historians have shown, that it wasn't until women came into the camps, and I don't mean the women of the saloon, but the women who came in and said, we need churches, we need schools, we need... That's what civilized the West. And law came, and with that law came protection. Because it becomes obvious to every woman, but to us guys who are so thick-headed. they want protection. When she marries her husband, she wants someone to protect her, feed her, care for her, provide for her, and bring order and peace. And that's what authority does. And I am going to get off on a 15-second sermon here. This starts with the man. That's where it's, all of the problems that have come is when the man doesn't do his job. And then when the feminists come and the feminists don't do their job, and I'm going to give it 15 more seconds. You know what the MGTOW movement is? I've talked to a couple of the ladies about that. MGTOW, M-G-T-O-W. You know what that is? It stands for men going their own way. It's not homosexuality. It's not what you think it is. It's men who said, why would I get married to these women who are mean, who are militant, who are angry, hard to get along with, and when it's all done and said, they take my house. And though it can't really be called a movement, I guess, per se, but there is clearly, you go online, go and you start, just punch that in, and you start watching and listening, which I've been doing the last couple of months. I'm just fascinated by it. The women who were the most militant feminists are turning men away. Why would I want that? Don't do that. And now women are saying, you know, we need to be more feminine because men don't want to marry another man who happens to be born a woman. And I thought, man, this is just more evidence and proof of what happens to a culture and a society that rejects the first word from the Creator about in the beginning there's a man and a woman and those two become one, one flesh, and it's put there by God, not by the government. It wasn't the governor that made my wife and I one. It was God creating us as He did and as we follow His and for you too. All right, now I'll stop reading. Okay, any question or comment about so far, there's so much that goes on that one follows another and just starts cascading into all kinds of social problems that we are sitting in the middle of now, and it's just an avalanche of all the dysfunction. Yes,
again. Well, just to add to what I was saying, you reminded me too. What's going on is they are actually separating those two topics so that there's the sex, which is the procreation part, and then the identity. That's how they're tackling this argument, and it's failing still, but We do need to be aware of that when we're talking to people because they'll fine-tune it and say, no, that's sex appropriation. That's different than how we identify. mm-hmm. not pulling it together, right? It's interesting.
Yeah, that's their conclusion on how they're going to be happy. And there's some, yeah, that's what they do. Compartmentalize their lives. And this is okay, that's okay, this is okay. There, someone else over there? All right. Well, what does this mean? Well, when we discuss these things, and there's just so many out there, that when we eventually come back in our thinking to the authority of the Lord, setting the order, inevitably we get to Romans chapter 1, when Paul is describing how men rejected that authority, professing to be wise, they became fools. And as he begins to discuss the idolatry that they began to fall into, then into the homosexuality, the women with women and men with men who were burned in their lust. And I don't know, but I guess it's true, because we see so many examples of that, where a man can have so many women that he just gets tired of women and he wants to turn to a man. I don't understand that. I don't know why. But I admit that it sure happens. But all of that dysfunction comes because they have rejected this formula right here. And the thing that scares me the most about this, and here's where I'll bring my thoughts together. The honest heart accepts this up here. The honest heart looks at this and says, okay, because that's really what we're discussing in regards to authority. Now, whatever question comes up in our discussions with friends or family, etc., and they may do as Ben explained about, well, we'll compartmentalize and I've got this and I've got that and I've got that. I'm happy with this and I'm happy with that. And notice how often people in the world want to convince you that they're happy. I'm really, really happy with this. Good. Let's see what the Lord says. No, I don't need that. The people with honest hearts, like the centurion in Matthew 8, they'll follow this and there'll be good things happen. The people with dishonest hearts, that is, they don't care, their hearts are going to suffer this fate. In Romans, the first chapter, and I'm just going to pull out three verses. And I know, I'm sure David has done this, and you've studied this before, and it's so obvious. Verse 24, verse 26, verse 28. The phrase is repeated three times. God gave them up. Romans 1:24. Therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity. I get the picture of a frustrated parent who has tried everything and finally says, all right, I give up. I can't do or say anything to help you with this. What a sad thing for God when we say, no, God doesn't give up on us. Well, I'm not sure about that. Here's some statements in the New Testament that says he does. When we reach a point of degradation and of rebellion, where we will reject the authority of God, to that point where we would so dishonor ourselves, Paul says God gave them up. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Verse 28, since they did not see it fitting to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind. There is a point of no return. And this is what scares me. I'm going to give you two thoughts about our class and then we're done. The first thing that strikes me about all of this discussion about gender identities and gender behavior, gender dysfunction, gender confusion, all the things that are going on, and that's a big topic. I'm not worried about that in that sense. It can't sustain itself. I've read several articles of people trying to say, well, the LGBT culture can continue with this, this, and this, and this. Well, things have to be just right for that thing to continue. And it is the government that seems to be the counter to it. That is the people who want to preserve their community in a godly way, at some point and in some way will resist and fight against that. But it may be in time that the government acquiesces and the sin pushes the government out of the picture and it's completely gone. Now that's a scary thought. But one of those two is going to happen. It can't sustain itself. And then when it gets to that point, it's at the Sodom and Gomorrah degree. And the Lord takes care of that. Let's just get out of the way of that one. So in that respect, I don't worry a lot about it. You know, people, oh, that's terrible. Yes, it is bad. I'm not worried about that because the Lord's going to take care of that one way or the other. What I do worry about, of course, is our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and the futures that come to all of the Christians here and around the world who are subject to all of this nonsense in schools and in communities and with circles of friends where they are taught. That tells me the parents have to have a huge counterweight against this. They have to develop a strength and a force to meet this and then defeat this in the minds of our children, because that's where it's going to happen. And I know I've heard David say this here, and you all will understand there too. You know, the conversions aren't in the pews, and the teaching and the development isn't done in the Bible class. Though they learn a lot, it's that daily confirmation from mom and dad in what they say and in what they do that teaches these children to be the people they should be. Speaking of a teaching father, Tyler?
So, sticking with Romans 1, you know, in verse 26, when it says, "For this reason God gave up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to them, and men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another." I mean, Ben brought up this idea that there's this idea that sex and gender, or sex and identity, are two different things. And, I mean, to me, that's kind of the response to that. There is, you're a man, you're a woman, you were born for that, your body was made for that, God created it, or in the way it is, for a specific purpose. How you feel inside, you have to align that to God. We can separate out our identity from our body. Our body was created for a purpose, and God gave it a natural purpose. And then how I feel inside, and we can, you know, whether it's about gender or anything else, I have to align that to God's, you know, authority, which is kind of where we start this whole thing, right?
That's
and so actually, I would not necessarily disagree with the transgender advocates in that sense. What's interesting about that is they want to conform their identity, their outward identity, to culture, to our cultural norms, which at the same time they reject. And so, there's just, it's
can't have it both ways.
It's complete confusion. And the fact is, you can exist in your body the way God created it, regardless of how you feel inside. And you have to use your body the way God gave you your body, and you have to change your mind and align your mind, conform your mind to the mind of Christ, regardless of what else is happening.
Do you remember? I know it's not fair to ask you about something that was taught several months ago, but last summer when I was teaching for that month on social issues, and one of them had to deal with this very topic, and I had a letter from a lady who had been a lesbian for many, many years, had a large community of lesbian friends, etc., who was converted. She thought she was a Christian. She was converted to the gospel, immediately stepped out of it. She married a man, raised four children. He's now preaching the gospel, she's saying. And she writes a letter about this very thing. She said, "My feelings didn't stop. I still have these feelings towards my sisters that I love deeply. But my feelings towards Christ is more important. And my subjection..." And I have this letter, and some of you asked for copies of it. I'm sure I can pull it out. If you'd like a copy of it, it's wonderful. I mean, she just gets right to it. And she's more than qualified to write what she is writing. She was had her doctorate at the ladies' college back east, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right, if you like that, let me know, and I'll get you a copy of that. It deals with that thing head on. The second thing I would say is this, and I'm sure some of you probably thought about this, is that I'm kind of waiting for this next shoe to drop. As this argument is being made about, well, this is how I feel. You know, you can't stop me from my feelings because I was born this way. So the Lord made me this way. I'm waiting for a man, and I'm understanding that there are some that have already surfaced, who said, "Well, you understand, God made me love little boys. I'm a pedophile. So that's the way God made me, so it's not my fault. My response would be the same as what Fowler said, what this lady would say. I said, all right, I'm sorry he did. But that doesn't excuse your behavior. Right now, the only thing that's keeping it is that it, keeping them away from that is that it's illegal. How long will that remain? Until some nice group of assemblymen decide to make it legal. Now what do? You take your little boys and your little girls and you bundle them up and move to Mozambique. No, you can't move away from the problem. A boy, you can cure insulin, etc. All right, any other question? Oh, yeah, Alan, and then we're out of time.
I just wanted to add that what I think, what I'm interpreting what you're saying, and I agree with, is that we are getting into anarchy when we deal with this stuff because we're getting to a point where everybody thinks it's all right to do just what they want to do. What Scripture says, warned us not.
That's the only thing that keeps the wolf at the door. And Jesus said.
Now, when we get to this anarchy and all authority is gone, everybody's got their shotgun, everybody is doing what. And where are we as a nation, our culture?
Wait a minute. I read that in the Old Testament. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what? What was right in his own eyes. Thank you for your good attention. We're going to talk about grace Sunday. Grace and love.